Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning, Counsel.
May it please the Court, Michael Hannon. I represent Petitioner Dan Rappaport. I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. This case, Your Honors, is about a licensed securities broker who lived and worked in Moscow, Russia, and had almost no direct contact with investors in the United States, but on whom the SEC has now imposed draconian penalties for failing to register with the SEC. Mr. Rappaport petitions this court for...
That's a little incomplete, right? He failed to show up to defend himself. That's why we're here, right? We're here on whether the default judgment should have been set aside.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So...
Which is certainly what we're going to address today.
Right.
And our appeal does not, again, critically, the SEC's two errors are completely independent of the alleged willfulness of Rappaport's default. The SEC's errors are twofold. One is they applied a completely incorrect standard that expressly rejects the settled federal standard for dealing with default orders, the three-factor balancing test. The other error, the other abuse of discretion, is that the SEC imposed sanctions on Rappaport by default that are not even supported by the SEC's allegations in their OIP, in their complaint against Rappaport. And that's why Rappaport requests that the court reverse the default order, but in any event, eliminate the unsubstantiated and baseless sanctions that were imposed on Rappaport not supported by the allegations.
Remedy there would be to remand for an explanation, wouldn't it? Didn't it?
That would be one available remedy, Your Honor, just as Your Honor did in the Rockies Fund case. It would be much like that. Here, however, we believe it is so clear from the allegation. Well, first of all, the default order should be set aside in its entirety. But secondly, it's so clear from the allegations and the evidence that the SEC has put forth in the course of trying to defend its actions that there's no basis whatsoever for second-tier penalties. Indeed, as Your Honor mentioned, you know, with respect to sanctions, we do believe it's clear in the circuit if the SEC wants its sanctions to pass muster, it must explain its reasoning, it must provide a rational explanation of why a sanction was appropriate, and it must address potentially mitigating factors. That's clear in this circuit. Cases are legion. Judge Williams and Judge Santel, you both addressed that in your opinions.
Does it make any difference to that issue that this is on default as opposed to the normal case we get in which the respondent has shown up to defend himself?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The fact that it's a default only means that because of the default, well-pled allegations in the complaint in the OIP here are accepted as true. And so what the SEC had an obligation to do, which is why we pressed the SEC, we pressed the law judge.
Didn't they allege scienter?
We do not believe they allege scienter. And in fact, there's one allegation in the OIP, it's OIP paragraph 14, where there's a vague allegation to Rappaport's knowledge that CI Moscow representatives had to register. In the paragraph immediately preceding that, there's a recognition that had CI New York, the New York broker-dealer, maintained certain records, Russian broker-dealers would not have had to register at all. And so the allegation is not only a bald legal conclusion, it's contradicted.
So I don't have the OIP in front of me, but I have notes from my reading of the OIP. And my notes show, and if I wrote this down wrong, I could have, Rappaport knew that any representative of CI Moscow who solicited a U.S. investor would have to be licensed and registered with the commission.
That's correct.
He knew that.
That's the allegation. Right. We submit it's an empty legal conclusion, and so it's not necessarily sufficient to support an allegation on default. But more critical,
no, how's that an empty legal conclusion?
There are no facts involved. There's no allegation as to how Rappaport.
So you're saying they'd have to say he knew because
that is what we're saying in terms of properly girding the penalties that were ultimately imposed. But I think the more compelling reason that's insufficient.
That begins to look like a challenge to the validity of the finding.
Yeah.
Right. In other words, you're saying there should be more detail, and I can well imagine a case where a litigated dispute, an agency just comes up with some flat conclusion, the basis for which is very dubious. You know, we might need to take action, but here, it's an allegation. It's like a complaint.
Excuse me, Your Honor. In this case, the allegation is not well pleaded, not only because we think it's too empty, but because it's flatly incorrect as a factual matter. It's contradicted by the immediately preceding allegation that said...
that JA reference as to where the OIP is?
Certainly.
Follow the immediately preceding paragraph a little more convincingly.
It is JA 28.
Okay.
And if you look at paragraph 13... there's an allegation that essentially contradicts paragraph 14, because the reality is there are numerous reasons that a registered, or I should say a licensed securities broker in Moscow can communicate with U.S. investors, can send research to U.S. investors without having to register in the U.S.
Quite see the flat contradiction.
Yeah.
In other words, 13 and 14 can be reconciled pretty easily as long as there's no reason for Rappaport to think that the condition required in 13 has been fulfilled.
They're certainly reconcilable. By the same token, there's a way that they are irreconcilable when you delve into the facts.
If they're reconcilable, then they're not irreconcilable. We're not dealing with two cities where this was the best of times or the worst of times.
we submit, Your Honors, that if that allegation is the sole basis for second-tier penalties against Rappaport, the maximum second-tier penalties for 5 years, that's woefully insufficient. But
That may be, but that's a different thing than saying they're flatly contradictory.
I apologize, Judge.
Yes, they're rather easily.
I was addressing Judge Griffith's question, but you're absolutely correct. The with respect to the basis for those penalties, it is less clear, and we can go through the OIP paragraph by paragraph and talk about what are the allegations to support penalties in 2003, 4, and 5. And
2003 is the short year.
2003 is the very short year where there were 3 weeks and no allegations of anything whatsoever. And 2004 and 2005 are years where it's clear the SEC has no basis.
No allegations whatsoever, but there are, correct say, general allegations covering 03.
Very generalized allegations. In that case, and we provide cases in our brief on this point, there are three or four reasons those two allegations, paragraph 1 and paragraph 9, are not well pleaded and cannot form the basis for $185,000 in maximum second-tier penalties against someone who is living and working in Moscow, whose conduct is alleged to have harmed no one, caused no investor to even complain. And most fundamentally, we submit there's a credibility problem on the SEC's part in imposing these penalties in a way that clearly was thoughtless and careless. When 6 months before they even brought the OIP against Rappaport, they proposed changing the rules. And I think it's telling what the SEC said, what Eric Seery, the director of the Enforcement Division, said to the SEC 6 months before bringing the claims against Rappaport. He proposed eliminating these requirements because he said they were unworkable, impractical, and imposed unnecessary operational and compliance burdens on foreign broker-dealers like Rappaport. But now the SEC seeks to penalize Rappaport with severe penalties for violating precisely those unworkable and unnecessary rules. And for those reasons, whether it's because there's absolutely no basis in the complaint, except it is true for these penalties, or because they're truly excessive in the context of this case, the penalties should be vacated against Rappaport, at least with respect to all second-tier penalties and penalties for 2003, 4, and 5. And we think that the carelessness with which the ALJ and the Commission approach these penalties is evident from their opinion, particularly the SEC's opinion, where we hammered this issue home with the Commission in our briefing, because we thought it was so unjust that he would be penalized for conduct that not only he wasn't alleged to have done, but conduct that we knew he didn't do. And we knew that because the SEC provided all of its evidence below. And there was...
No, he didn't do part is rings a little more hollow than it would if you had shown up and defended.
And that's certainly true, but in terms of corroborating the absence of any basis for these penalties, we think it's meaningful that there simply is no evidence.
Can I go back to the default issue? Is it your position that he didn't know about the SEC proceedings?
About the SEC proceedings? No, it's not. There's no question he hired an attorney. There's no question that his attorney showed up. And there's no question his attorney initially made a motion to oppose directed service on Rappaport's attorney in the U.S. while in Russia.
Right.
What we do know, however, is that there's absolutely no obligation on the part of a defendant or a respondent here to make himself available for service. And that was very clear in this court's decision in Kegel, the seminal case on default orders, where the district court said exactly that. You know,
Do you know of any instance where Kegel has been applied to a Rule 155 proceeding in the SEC?
Directly, no, we don't. But we also know no instance where it necessarily hasn't been.
Right.
What we have seen
Is the SEC bound to follow Kegel in its interpretation of its default proceedings?
In this particular case, we submit that they are.
Well, don't we give them our deference? I mean, these are their rules. Don't we defer to their reasonable interpretation?
Exactly, Judge Griffith.
You said he's not reasonable.
The court defers to a reasonable interpretation by an agency.
This is Vermont Yankee deference. This is, if anything, even stronger than the usual deference we would be throwing out on Chevron or something.
Well, I would submit, Judge Sintel, that it's not as strong as Chevron deference for a variety of reasons. In part, this agency rule has nothing whatsoever to do with the substantive nature of its regulations. It's also a matter
Chevron,
of...
Chevron, contrary to popular belief, does not require expertise deference. It is the allocation of the responsibility, the delegation from Congress, that is the fundamental of Chevron deference. And at least the same underlies Vermont Yankee deference in that the Supreme Court has said convincingly an agency has to have its own rules to operate by, and as long as they're applying them, the courts ought to let them.
And we understand that, and we submit that in this particular case, and none of the cases cited by the SEC address an issue like this, a matter of judicial review, where the SEC or the agency comes out and says, we're going to interpret our rule, the rule we've been relying on from day one, and the rule that the Division of Enforcement relied on in their briefs, and expressly rejected, and without any explanation. And
well, what I think we'll get to that. They have their turn.
As they will, but I think it's important before they have their turn to explain that the SEC's interpretation of their own rule makes no sense. And that in terms of giving, you can give them all the deference that would be appropriate, and yet to have a rule that tells a defaulting party to state their defenses, but then at the same time say, we're not going to listen to your defenses because, sorry, you didn't file a timely answer. And so your defenses are irrelevant. To us, that rule doesn't make any sense. And that interpretation of the rule was an ex post, post hoc justification for what was a sloppy decision by the SEC. And to boot, in this particular situation, we think there's a unique differentiation between, in terms of the need for deference, in that this default order is subject to the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts. Because when the SEC seeks to exceed its administrative obligations, when it seeks to do more than impose a cease and desist order, or more than bar someone for life, which they did to Rappaport here, and they seek to impose hundreds of thousands of dollars in civil penalties, they have to go to federal court to enforce that judgment. And given that they have to bring the default order to federal court in order to enforce, federal rules of civil procedure will apply when they do that.
That seems to me to be a non sequitur. We start out with the question, do federal rules of civil procedure have to apply to an agency decision that we're reviewing? And you circle all the way around and come back to say, well, yes, you have to because you're a federal court and you're reviewing it. If that were the case, if I thought that were the case, we wouldn't be asking you this question.
Well, Judge, I appreciate the point you're making. I think this is different here. It's truly, I don't know if it's sui generis, but it's certainly a unique situation where the error at issue relates to a default order, and the standard that the SEC and agency needs to apply with respect to this issue of judicial review, what's good cause for a default order? And it just so happens that the default order that the SEC is going to get, it needs to take to a federal court, at which point we think it would be appropriate for Rappaport to say...
no reason. We're not making a new evidentiary decision. We're not having a new evidentiary hearing. We don't apply any rules of evidence in this court. We don't take evidence. I do not see how it remotely follows as a chain of logic that because we are reviewing an evidentiary decision, the maker of the evidentiary decision had to apply court rules. That takes all deference out of it.
In a way, Judge Sintel, it's a belt and suspenders argument. I think it just gives some color. It just so happens.
I commend you for not leading with that argument.
I think it's far more compelling that the SEC adopted this rule, constantly adopts federal rule analogs and relies on them. And tellingly, the only way the SEC obtained allegedly directed service on Rappaport in this case was by ignoring its own rule regarding service and by relying on the federal rule, Rule 4F. Because under the SEC's rule for service, directed service on Rappaport's counsel would not have been appropriate. And so we think sort of the pick and choose which federal rules we like routine is not appropriate here and resulted in prejudice to our client.
Thank you, counsel. We have talked to you well past your time.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Minutes for rebuttal. We'll hear from the respondent.
May it please the court, the commission acted within its discretion when it denied Rappaport's Rule 155B motion to set aside the default. Your Honor is correct. The commission does get deference in this situation. It is interpreting its own rule of practice, Rule 155B, which...
Well, isn't it supposed to follow its own interpretations of Rule 155?
That's correct. And this...
You cited at page 21 of your brief four cases for the proposition that the commission has declined to consider proposed defenses when defaulting parties cannot justify their failures to answer or do not timely move to set aside the default. Well, I looked at the four cases, and they seem to me to fit into two categories. There are two in which the individual offered no defense at all, so the question of the defense did not come up. And the other two, there's no discussion whatever of a defense. Presumably, none was offered. And there's no language in those saying we totally disregard material offered by way of defense under particular circumstances that I could see. If you can find it, point me to it.
No, I apologize for interrupting, Judge Wynn. That's correct about those cases. We cited those cases for examples in which a court, the commission, after determining that there's been a willful default, did not go on to consider defenses.
In two of them, it explicitly chided the party for not offering a defense. It did consider defense. It considered specifically the absence of any defense having been offered. But, I mean, the cases do not stand for the proposition you cite them for.
We don't cite them for the proposition of a situation where the commission has expressly discussed the rule that the commission discussed.
The commission has declined to consider proposed defenses when defaulting parties cannot justify their failure to answer or do not timely move to set aside the default. And then you follow with citations. They don't support that proposition. It didn't decline to consider.
It did not consider those defenses, though. I mean, the circumstances...
Well, there's indication in two of them, explicitly by the SEC, that none was offered, and in the other two, there's no reference to defenses whatever from which it seems fair to infer that none was offered.
They do not
stand for the proposition you cite them for at all.
Even if that's correct.
It is correct.
But that does not necessarily mean that the interpretation offered by the commission here does not comport with Rule 155.
But are you saying that this is a new interpretation, just that the commission hasn't offered before?
Because
it hasn't been faced with this circumstance? Or what? I mean, what's your position then?
This is the case that that's come up where the commission has been faced with the circumstance.
A previous case in which the commission has, in fact, declined to consider a proffered defense.
We did not find a case where there's been an express statement like the commission made here. We do not have a case.
Are there cases in which the commission has actually considered the defenses?
Yes, there are some in which the commission.
There was willfulness. They found willfulness, and yet they still consider the defenses.
That's correct.
So that's inconsistent with the position they're taking here.
No, I don't think that's inconsistent.
Why not?
Because I think the key is discretion. It's that. That merely because there is or is not a willful default doesn't necessarily mean you can or cannot go on to consider defenses. The key, as several circuits have stated, including the Fifth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit, is that if there is an intentional finding of willfulness, there need be no other findings. That doesn't mean there can't be other findings. But it's simply that if a commission or
how does the commission exercise its discretion in this regard? Are there any guidelines or principles that it relies upon to say?
It exercises...
In this case, the finding of willfulness is sufficient. We won't look at defenses. In this case, we will. What's the guide?
Like all default situations, it's a facts and circumstances. It depends on the circumstances of the particular default.
That's not an answer. They cannot arbitrarily and capriciously choose between litigants as to how they apply the rules. Now, the federal rules are applied by the courts according to the three parts that were described in the briefing, and you would look at the defenses, you would look at the reason for default. That may or may not be a proper interpretation of 155, but it's one or it's the other. Either they do have to consider these, or they don't, or they can explain why they consider them or they don't. They can do it consistently, but you can't arbitrarily and capriciously choose between parties.
I understand that, Your Honor, but when...
So how do we know what was done here?
How do we know the default was...
...of why they didn't consider this defense if they have, in some prior cases, considered it?
They didn't consider the defense here because the default was willful in the following way. Rappaport, or the commission found that Rappaport knew about the order directing him to respond by a certain date. That date was March 2nd. Mm-hmm. He never responded.
He knew that differentiate it from the cases you refer to in which they have, in fact, considered defenses?
My understanding in cases in which, in the one I'm thinking of, which name I cannot remember, is that there was a mistake, an inadvertence.
You submit to us, and I'll certainly permit response, we'd like to have cross-briefing, an additional briefing on the prior history of the SEC's application of receiving or not receiving defenses in default circumstances.
Okay, Your Honor.
What we have is rather inadequate, I think. All right, let's say 10 business days for your filing, 5 more days for review by the response by the other side. Is that agreeable to my colleagues? And then we'll limit that to 10 pages to the side.
10 pages per side, yes, Your Honor.
But you can cite the cases that establish the proposition you're seeking to establish, right? So we can look at them. They may be longer.
So you may have additional pages for those things appended to the brief.
But presumably that can all be found on the web.
Your argument itself should be done in 10 pages unless you come forward with some good explanation, which we can then arbitrarily and capriciously refuse.
I understand, Your Honor. I did want to point, again, I did want to discuss the willfulness that is involved here, at least the Commission's finding of willfulness. There is the issue of Rappaport's disappearance throughout the proceedings. Rappaport knew about these proceedings as early as December 2008. He actually knew about the investigation even earlier than that. He knew about the dispute over service, and he knew that the order had been filed or issued by the ALJ requiring him to answer by a certain date, but that answer was never made. The reason the Commission found that the default was willful in the circumstances, it was not reasonable for Rappaport to believe he was not under any obligation to respond, and it wasn't reasonable for him.
Was he ever served?
He was served through with the OIP through Kraut, through his attorney.
Was that according to the rules of the SEC?
Yes, Rule 141. It permits. Directed service by any method reasonably calculated to give notice, provided and. This, I think, is what counsel for Rappaport was alluding to, that the method of service used is not prohibited by the law of the foreign country. But there's been no indication here that directed service on an attorney is somehow prohibited by the law of Russia. He simply never responded. He didn't reappear in the proceedings until December 2009, about a year after service was directed against him, 5 months after the default, and 2 months after he claims he first learned about the default order. I did want to turn to the issue of...
When you face the interpretation of Rule 155 again, you'll want to show that any case where the Commission deliberately refuses to look at a defense involves a case with at least as bad behavior in terms of reasonableness of non-response as Mr. Rappaport's.
Yes, we'll
do that. Otherwise, it would not be a useful precedent for you.
We'll do what we can. Just to turn to the sanctions very quickly, because...
We may give you extra time to discuss this with us. Go ahead.
What's that?
We may give you some extra time to discuss this with us. Go ahead, Ken.
Understand. As to the sanctions, I think it's important to frame how the sanctions argument was presented to the Commission. It was presented within the context of the Rule 155B motion. Rappaport's argument to the Commission was that the sanctions were unjust because they were unsupported by the allegations in the OIP. The Commission then explained in its order that, in fact,
where is the best explanation of the sanctions?
The Commission's order.
Give me the JA page of your best explanation of the sanctions.
Up front. If you look at JA 23 and 24, which is in the first volume, the Commission's explanation, as Ms. Rappaport's counsels point out, is succinct, but it's responding to a succinct argument, because the entire argument was there are no allegations supporting the sanctions. What the Commission did was point to the allegations that, in fact, support those sanctions.
Where on that page, what it is you're referring to?
This would be on the subheading D, alleged injustice, the two paragraphs that follow.
Yeah, the default, insofar as establishing liability, and the range of the sanctions are two different questions. And is this an explanation of why you impose second-tier maximum second-tier sanctions, including for the three-week year?
I think there's two questions in there. The first is, does it support the imposition of second-tier sanctions? And yes.
They explained the imposition of second-tier sanctions.
Yes, because it's referring to
where is that?
It's referring to, in the footnote, it's referring to the excerpts from the OIP that quote the paragraphs.
See Supra Note 7.
Correct. Which then cites back to the allegations in the OIP, which are accepted as true on default, that indicate that, as was pointed out before, paragraph 14 of the OIP, that Rappaport knew that any representative of CI Moscow who solicited U.S. investor would have to be licensed and registered with the commission or an appropriate U.S. regulatory organization.
Has the commission imposed maximum second-tier sanctions on everyone who knowingly, who knew those things and violated?
I don't know the answer to that.
You wouldn't find it out here either. So there's not really an explanation of your sanctions here, is there?
There's an explanation that the allegations, again, supported the sanctions, which was the entire argument, because it, it refers...
Most tell us is that the commission could impose these sanctions. See, what I think we're looking for under Rocky's Fund and some other cases is an explanation of why they did impose these sanctions. I mean, the law, it's a, one thing to say the law allows us on this kind of allegation to impose these things. It's quite another to say we're going to impose the maximum, even for that three-week year.
But
now, the three-week year, was it not separately called to their attention by counsel for Rappaport? And their response was something like, well, it's incident by incident and not a time period measure for sanctions.
That's correct. It's not year by year.
Exactly.
It's act by act.
That might be a pretty good explanation of why they could do it. But I think under Rocky's Fund, we would be looking for an explanation of why they did do it.
But the explanation due here, the ALJ explained in its order, in the default order, when it was imposing the sanctions, why it was imposing those sanctions.
All right, tell me where the best place is that tells me that.
That would be the ALJ's order, the ALJ's default order, which is available. The discussion of sanctions occurs in that order at JA 462. Through JA 467. And a paragraph to focus on would be on JA 463. Actually, really, the whole page on JA 463, where the ALJ walks through the factors that the ALJ is considering when deciding what sanctions to impose, and then discusses two paragraphs later Rappaport's conduct. With regard to those factors. In particular, it focuses on the willful and recurring nature of the conduct, and it also focuses on his lack of assurance against any future violations of the wrongful nature recognition of the wrongful nature of his conduct, which, of course, is going to happen since he didn't show up to defend himself. The ALJ then uses those findings to impose the sanctions it imposes. Rappaport, once he reappears in the proceeding, moves to set aside, saying that those sanctions are unjust.
Based upon the discussion above, it is in the public interest to issue the cease and desist orders.
Yes, and then
that's the final paragraph of that discussion you just said it to.
Yes, and then
That's not offered yet, at least. You may go on to tell me why that supports the maximum second-tier sanction as well. But so far, you've only justified the cease and desist order under the ALJ's opinion. Is that not correct?
That is correct, but the ALJ then goes on page 466 and 467
okay.
To discuss the penalties themselves.
Okay.
467, JA 467.
In this case, the actions of the defaulting respondents demonstrate deliberate or reckless disregard of regulatory requirements according to the appropriate that each of the defaulting respondents pay a second-tier penalty. Now, does that necessarily make it follow that he would be imposed upon him, there would be imposed upon him the maximum second-tier penalty for each year, including the three-week year?
Yes, I think that's right, because it's each violative action as opposed to, so for instance, if this case had gone to...
Would it have been possible for the ALJ to have imposed a lesser penalty for each of those years, especially for the short year?
I think it's possible, yes.
So is there any explanation as to why the ALJ chose to impose this one? And there are some comparative cases given above there where lesser penalties were imposed in some of them, and I'm not sure how the ALJ differentiates out what's being cited there from what he's doing here.
I think in this instance, this is the explanation that is provided by the ALJ, and then the commission.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, then we'll hear from the petitioner in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few quick points in response. I think it's interesting that the counsel referred the court back to the ALJ's discussion of the basis for these penalties, because it was the deeply flawed reasoning in this ALJ opinion which is what caused us to appeal to the commission. Not only is there no meaningful explanation of why five maximum second-tier penalties were imposed, but in fact, this is the paragraph in which the ALJ improperly lumped together Rappaport with his co-defendants, who were charged with different conduct during different years, and in fact, different violations of the law. And then worse, ordered Rappaport to pay a $555,000 civil penalty, which he later admitted was based on faulty math. And so we believe that this type of penalty, imposing $250,000 in penalties based on faulty math on an absent respondent, really demonstrates the carelessness with which the ALJ applied his analysis. With respect to the service on Rappaport being appropriate pursuant to the SEC rule, counsel referenced the SEC's rule which permits service based on any method calculated to give reasonable notice that is not inconsistent with the foreign country's law. That rule happens to be materially different than the federal rule on which the ALJ relied to direct service, which allows for any method of service that gives actual notice, not inconsistent with an international agreement. It's actually such that the federal courts have broader latitude to serve foreign respondents than the SEC does. And what's ironic is, in this case, the ALJ was unable to rely on SEC rules and SEC case law to support directed service. And the ALJ opinion expressly adopts the federal rule, because in reality, directed service is in violation of Russian law, whereas it's not in violation of the Hague Convention.
To say it's in violation of Russian law is a little overstatement, isn't it, counsel?
It's overstated to the extent, Judge Sentell, that I can't show you an affidavit from a Russian lawyer saying that it is. Based on all the information in the record, we think it's pretty clear that it's not. What's clear is the SEC needed to go rely on the federal rule in order to direct service on Rappaport. I think we would submit on the arguments to this point and ask that the court set aside the default order and in any event vacate all unsubstantiated and severe penalties against Rappaport. Thank you, Your Honor.
One housekeeping item. The table of contents is remarkably unhelpful.
I mean,
a list of R numbers and then page numbers. I understand that you can put it together with the next document and actually find out what you're interested in, but it's hard for me to imagine a less helpful table of contents, except for a completely missing table of contents.
Which we are at times. That has happened.
If we see you again, we will have a superior table of contents. I apologize for that.
Yes. That case, then, the case is submitted. We will look forward to receiving further briefing on the question we directed.